What is up, and welcome back to 24 minutes of A24, the podcast that takes a look at the A24 library 24 minutes at a time. I'm Ethan Simi.
And I'm Ben Lawhorn. This week on the pod, we are revisiting Alex Garland's divisive, to say the least, 2022 film, Men.
A young woman goes on a solo vacation to the English countryside following the death of her ex-husband. This movie, obviously directed by Alex Garland, starring Jesse Buckley and Rory Kinnear. We're here, Ben. We're doing a Men rewatch, a repod. Can you believe it?
How am I here? This is insane.
I cannot believe you agreed to this. I can't believe you didn't dip out like you did with the Idol. I fully expected you to be like, yo, I got to bring a ringer in and do it for me.
Yeah, I should have thought this out.
Well, before we talk about Men, a movie that we both rewatched in preparation for this. Did you rewatch it?
I did. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Full commit. Okay. Wow. That's great. A movie we both rewatched for this episode of the pod, gearing up for next week, gearing up for new Alex Garland in Civil War, which I know we have thoughts on, which is very, very exciting. We have a couple of housekeeping things. I think like a few housekeeping things. We did get a trailer for Janet Planet, a movie that looks really sad and really good.
And really A24. I mean, we're getting a coming of age directorial debut. Like, outside of horror, this is exactly what A24 does. So I'm so excited.
Yeah. I'm excited. I think the trailer actually looks quite good. I believe the actress is I don't know, the main actress, Julianne Nicholson, she is also recently in Dream Scenario with Nick Cage. I believe she plays his wife. So that was cool to see, a little A24 blood. Janet Planet played at New York Film Festival last year. So I guess at this time, like 6 or 7 months ago now, and it's kind of not been really talked about since then, but it's finally coming out. It's coming out in June. It supposedly is going to be theaters nationwide. Did you catch that on the tweet? Because I was very keen on seeing like, oh, we're going everywhere first.
Yeah, that seemed interesting and very almost un-A24 to do. Like, we're just going to give it to everybody at once rather than roll it out over 3 weeks or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know. Kind of cool. I'm excited. Yeah. I think a June release is interesting because like, it's going to be a big summer blockbuster, era going on, and then trying to like squeeze this little A24 coming of age film in between all of that. I'm afraid it might get lost a little bit, but we'll see.
Maybe they're going for the counter programming. Like the people are going to be sick of whatever big summer blockbusters, want something small. I don't know how well it's going to work out, but I hope it goes well.
I hope it goes well as well. We'll definitely be talking about it here on the pod. Second piece of news. Euphoria season 3. This has been in the news as of late because obviously we do not have a Euphoria season 3 yet. Season 2 concluded like 2 years ago, I think, almost. So we do not have a season 3. It has been further delayed, but HBO is reportedly still intent on making new episodes eventually. HBO told the actors to take other jobs, even though they were specifically told not to take other jobs because they were supposed to be working on Euphoria season 3. So a lot of not happy people in that camp. And reportedly, Zendaya had proposed some rewrites to the script for Rue and for her character and for her character arc. And they were all shot down by HBO / Sam Levinson. So like,
okay.
It's not looking good on the Euphoria front. We'll just put it that way.
No, I mean, anytime they're telling them like, yeah, go find other work, that's not a good sign that they're going to start shooting anytime soon. I mean, people have been joking about this for a long time, but honestly, at this point, they have to go to college or have to be in their 40s or something. Like, it's just
we
got to
do a major time jump. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Let's make something like that happen. I don't know. I feel mixed on it. I know like some of Euphoria has been really good, but some of the reports that came out of that season 2 and the treatment of the cast members and stuff, and it's like, I don't know, this is kind of weird. Like, maybe it's good just to like let it fade away.
Euphoria is such a fascinating time capsule to me because like season 1 was huge. Everybody was talking about Euphoria, and I remember that I was not watching it, and so I was like, what's like, I don't get it. What's the big deal? And like when it came out, it was a big deal because of how much it did push the boundaries, you know, a la A24 style, like they've done with The Idol and The Curse and other television shows that they've produced and distributed. And season two, I'm on the record about being very cold about the final couple of episodes. And obviously the direction that Sam Levinson chose to go. I'm also on the record about being very pro the Rue episode and the Jules episode and like having these middle things that both of them actually wrote and starred in and like got to make. So for me, so far what we have of Euphoria is such an interesting little capsule in like, hey, it works when you let people be creative, and it definitely doesn't work when you don't let them. And obviously, like you mentioned, everything with Sam Levinson. And then on top of that, like Angus Cloud is just no longer here. So what do you do? Like, how do you move forward with that storyline? I think the entire show is in shambles. And quite frankly, I think we should just scrap it and try to let it fade away. Try to push it under the rug and try to just be like, you know what? Didn't work. We're not going to pursue it any further.
Yeah. Send it out to the pasture. Let it live its last days and let's move on.
Yeah, I agree. We do not need to Stranger Things this thing. last piece of news related to Alex Garland, related to Civil War coming up next week and Men we're talking about today. Alex Garland reportedly not interested in directing films anymore. Question mark? It was seemingly like misquoted and misreported, but there is still some validity to it because he mentioned kind of falling out of love with the process of filmmaking and what that entails and how he really needs to find the right thing to get locked into. What's your take? Because Civil War comes out in a week and it's being heralded as like his best movie yet and his best movie ever. I think it's an odd time to like come like be very forthright and just be like, I don't know if filmmaking is right for me.
Yeah, it's a really interesting time to have this conversation. I mean, it makes sense, I guess, on a press tour because that's when he's getting asked all this stuff. But from what I understand, is he basically more intended that he wants to focus on writing some more and less of the actual directing, which I think is great because, I mean, he started out as a writer, you know, doing The Beach and 28 Days Later and Dread, all that kind of stuff before getting into doing the Ex Machina and all that kind of stuff. So if he's able to spend some time writing stuff, I think that'd be great. And if anything, I'm just glad he's like recognizing like maybe I'm a little burnt out on directing. Let me focus my attention somewhere else. He's done for the most part, his track record is pretty solid. So I look forward to whatever he puts out next.
Yeah, I think it'll be good. I think he should continue to write, obviously. I know we talked briefly last week about Ex Machina and revisited that quite briefly, but I think that was his best script, and I think there's something special there. I do think he's directed quite well, but I would be curious because Hollywood, unfortunately, right now does have like a director-writer problem where it's like, that's really cool that you wrote and directed this thing, but also it would have been so much better if you just let someone else behind the camera, which is something that is hard for a lot of writers and directors to realize or to come to grips with, I'm sure. I can only imagine. I just think it's an odd time to be having this conversation. Like you said, I think we should focus on Civil War coming out and then revisit this conversation after Civil War has kind of passed and is out of the news cycle. But I don't know how long that'll be. I don't know. People might be talking about Civil War for a while. Like, I don't know. We'll see. If you were on the red carpet, if you got to ask Alex Garland one question, do you know what you would ask him?
Ask Alex Garland one question. I have no idea. I feel on the spot now. I have no clue. What would you ask him?
I have zero idea. I don't know. I wanted to put you on the spot so you could vamp and then give me more time to figure out what I was going to ask him.
Wouldn't it be film related? Like, what's your favorite dessert? I'm an ice cream guy. What are you into?
What about you?
What's your thing?
You mix it up.
They're getting
man.
Asked all these questions about movies and shit. Like, let's have some fun here.
Yeah, that's actually probably a good call. I always think that's good. You know, break the ice a little bit, go a little little personable.
What is your dessert of choice, Ethan?
My personal dessert of choice, if I could have like, you know, everything at my disposal, I would actually go for Tillamook brand. Have you ever had Tillamook brand?
Yeah, it's Tillamook's the best.
Okay, good. So it's obviously originated in Oregon. So it's an Oregon thing. Tillamook brand chocolate chip ice cream. Like, ooh, you give me a gallon of that and you put me in front of Babylon. Oh, wow. That's it. We've peaked as a society. I don't think it gets better than that.
That's amazing. You and I are similarly close, other than Babylon, because you give me a gallon of mint chocolate chip.
Ooh.
I am on board. That is, wow, that is my jam.
Okay, that's what we need to do next. Live watch along with gallons of
with some ice cream. Yeah, we're simple creatures, man.
Yeah, definitely an ice cream guy, though. Are you pro milkshake?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'm absolutely pro milkshake. Yeah, they can't. I honestly, a baked goods are not my jam. I can't. My wife is obsessed with donuts. Not for me.
I love ice cream, but like a froyo or a frozen custard, like, it just doesn't hit the same. I've got to have ice cream.
Yeah, and my children are dairy free, so you can imagine my pain when I'm like, let's go get a milkshake. And everybody's like, I want ice cream. And I'm like, oh, I guess we'll go to a sorbet shop instead.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty disappointing. I wonder, Alex Garland, is he an ice cream man? It's a great question.
Now, you know, next time you see him,
we'll figure it out. Hey, Alex, have your people reach out to us. We're curious.
That's a question for any guest that we have on this show. What's your favorite dessert of choice? You got anything at your disposal? What do you have in?
I bet you would learn a lot about somebody.
I think you do. I feel like I learned a lot about you. I had no idea you were an ice cream person. Here we are.
Oh, absolutely. There's zero question. How do we bridge the gap from ice cream to men? A lot of men like ice cream, but maybe not the men in men. How about that?
True. True. Yes. Too much of one thing can make you feel bad. And there's a lot of Rory Kinnear in here. He's not bad, but it's just like a lot of Rory Kinnear.
It's a lot of Rory Kinnear. It's some CGI'd Rory Kinnear. It's some mouth implants and some teeth implants. Very interesting. So we visited men this film for episode 37 of this podcast. We are now on episode 141. So that was over 100 episodes ago.
Wow.
That was all the way back in May of 2022. Now, when the movie was released, we recorded it. I remember specifically, like, I went to the theater. It was me and one other couple. And the movie ended, and I specifically remember being in such a state of shock that I turned behind me and I was like, hey, what did you guys think of this movie? Because I just couldn't live with my own thoughts. I had to, like, figure out what the people around me thought.
Yeah.
That episode of our podcast was only 37 minutes long. So I don't know if we were trying to, like, stick to our namesake. I don't know if those were the days when we were like, short pods are it, but we're past that, Ben. We're here for the long haul on men tonight.
Unfortunately, that is true.
Good movie? I don't know. Where do we start? Obviously, we're going to do True Cinema. We're going to go through this, but, like, we're going to spoil Men. If you haven't seen it, we're going to spoil it. Is in a good movie?
So I was gonna say, like, it wasn't as bad as I have talked about it, you know, since seeing it. I think people, it's easy to shit on this movie, and I don't think it's that bad. I am surprised. I maybe should have gone back and listened to our episode, because I'm surprised that we both gave it a good time. But again, that was such a broad area. You know, you had a First Cow, which is like the best stuff. You had The Farewell, which, like, you never want to watch again. And then everything in the middle was a good time. And that was just like, that's a lot of shit, you know, so much stuff. So in rewatching this, though, like, I knew that I remembered enjoying Jesse Buckley's performance, and Rory Kinnear is doing a great job as all these different characters. Like, what was it about the movie? And it's like, I just don't know that its intent was clear or something, you know. It's just like, I don't understand. Like, I get some of it, and some of it's, like, heavy-handed, it seems like. Like, not all dudes, you know, like, they're not all bad. Or sometimes, like, shitty dudes can just breed other shitty dudes. Like, that happens, too. Like, I get it. But it just somehow didn't land, I guess, for some reason. But, like, surrounded by good performances and a fairly interesting concept, but it didn't all coalesce, I guess.
Okay, let me ask you this, and I realize I have not answered the question of is it a good movie, but let me ask you this question.
Yeah,
because I think this will kind of be the core center of our conversation tonight of Men, because I agree with you. I think it is primarily a good film. I actually do. I think we have some good performances with a fascinating script, with a very fascinating idea. of Rory Kinnear playing these other people and our ideas of men and generational kind of acidity and lots of other things, and guilt and trauma and death and the way society breeds, you know, how women feel sometimes. I think there's a lot at play that is actually really good. But of course, we get the famed final 15 minutes. That is kind of the eternal birth I have written down nice. Here on our notes. If, in order to make this movie a truly good movie, how does it need to end instead of what we devolve into with the CGI births and ultimately that side of things? How do we end the movie instead?
I mean, if I knew that, I'd be living in Hollywood, I think, you know, like, I don't know that I have the answer to
that
question.
Don't give away free ideas.
Yeah. Nothing, not giving away anything for free. I don't know exactly. That's the other thing is, like, does the ending not work or does it? Because, like, right. We remember it.
Exactly.
You know?
That's my question.
Like, I don't know that it needs to be different.
I think the argument is that it doesn't work, but I'm curious if the argument is more so that it is such a tonal and creative juxtaposition to the rest of the film, like you mentioned, where it doesn't coalesce.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
I really don't know what else you would do for those final 15 minutes to, like, give it what Garland is good at, which is kind of leaving a punch in the end. Mm-hmm. Ex Machina does that. This movie does it. I'm going to assume from what I've heard about Civil War, it does it as well. Annihilation famously does it as well. So, like, that's his kind of signature. I don't know what you do instead. Maybe as we talk about it, maybe something comes to mind and we think about it. But I am interested to know, like, A, how many drugs Garland took to, like, conceive this idea, and B, like, how many times during the production was he like, oh yeah, this is a good idea. We got to follow this. We got to keep going with this, guys. This is gold right here.
I think he was in, like, such a ice cream haze when he came up. He was like on his third gallon of ice cream. Like, you know what?
You know what we should do?
What if one guy gave birth to himself like four times and then her husband comes out? What about that? Like, it's a great idea. Yeah, I have no idea what drugs he's on, but yeah, I don't know. Like, maybe it is effective and people just don't like it because it's gross or because it's weird or whatever.
I think that's a great question. I think that's a totally plausible question.
I mean, that's what we've talked about every time this movie's come up, right? It's just like the movie, whatever, that ending though, like, that's one thing anybody who's seen this movie will remember, that ending 100%. And I think maybe that's proof of it being effective. I don't know. It's either effective or it's shocking, or maybe it's both, but I don't know. Maybe it's effective. Am I going to enjoy this movie by the end of this pod? I have no idea.
I feel this, like, you're crazy. Talking yourself into being this, like, wow, insane. This is one of the best A24s ever made.
This is insane. I can't believe we're having this conversation.
I love it. Okay. I have one more question for you before we do True Cinema. This is kind of a bigger and a broader question. Throughout the film, we get many flashbacks. Do these flashbacks that involve Harper, who is Jesse Buckley's character, we kind of get some idea and some context around her relationship with James, her husband, who killed himself, jumped out of a window, and whose hand was kind of stuck to a fence, noticeably split as our protagonist's hands are in the very end, our antagonist. And so lots of similarities there. But these flashbacks are always kind of in this red haze. We get three, four-ish of them. Do they work? Are they enough to round out this idea and this theme of, like, men cause women to feel guilty about anything?
I think so. I think all the flashbacks are pretty effective storytelling methods. You know, I mean, it can be risky to do that, but I think it all works here. Basically, without them, it doesn't work. You know, like, if you take all those out, then this doesn't matter. The ending doesn't matter or anything. So I do think they're effective. It's it's interesting how it gets brought up throughout, you know, with when she's checking in, it's like, oh, where's the hubby, you know, and all that. And then that interaction with the priest or whatever, he's like, oh, do you ever think maybe it was your fault for not forgiving him? So it's interesting how it comes up throughout her, like, modern day, like, mm-hmm. as things are unfolding. But I think the flashbacks are really effective in helping us understand who she is and why she's there and all that stuff.
I agree. I think the flashbacks are good, and I actually think we get the right amount. I think if we get too many more flashbacks, I think it becomes even more heavy-handed, which unfortunately it already is. And I'm curious if that plays into the final 15 minutes that we end up talking about like, we got it. We understood from all of the interactions with Joffrey, who is Roy Kinnear's mm-hmm. character, and Harper, like, we know what we're going for here. I wonder if that heavy-handedness is a big turnoff to a lot of people. But I think they work, and I actually really like kind of the color juxtaposition to the rest of the film, and the volume and the violence differences that we get in those flashbacks compared to Harper staying at Jeffrey's house. Okay. You want to do the true cinema? Are you ready to walk through this movie?
I guess so. I guess I'm up for it. Let's do it.
Oh, okay. We get the opening scene. This is James falling from the balcony above Harper's apartment. And in what we come to find out, he had burst into a neighbor's apartment, a floor above.
Yeah.
And in either him trying to climb over the balcony and down to Harper's apartment after being kicked out, or he slipped, he ended up falling. He locked eyes with Harper. We see her screaming, and we kind of get this silence in the beginning of the movie. I think it's a great tonal set for, like,
oh yeah,
what is happening. I think it's also just, maybe not like shocking, but it's just like uncomfortable enough to be like, oh wow, okay, like, I'm sure she's got some issues. I'm sure she has some problems dealing with this thing that happened.
Without a doubt. I mean, it leads you to some obviously questions like, okay, how did we get here? Which I think is the first thing that Alex Garland is wanting people to ask. Like, oh, this is, does she know that man? Like, what is happening here? Like,
right.
Like, what's going on? And then obviously, like, we get the full context later on, honestly, like, anything in slow-mo just kind of looks cool, and this looked cool. It was like, it was weird, it was creepy, but it looked pretty cool.
It did. It looked cool, and, like, I'm sure the red kind of overlay that we get, there's some portion of Garland that was just like, yeah, it looks kind of bitching, guys. Yeah, like, we should just keep with it. Like, it looks pretty cool.
Yeah, I don't know what the context is for it at all, other than, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. And that's another question that I have about the movie that maybe we dissect as we go is, like, are some of its choices, some of its biblical allegories, obviously some of its, like, very thematic stances, like, are they enough? Like, I know I just talked about the film being heavy-handed, but, like, we get, you know, we obviously very, very quickly here on our next bullet point, the meeting and the tour of Jeffrey's house, we see Harper meet Jeffrey. She gets the tour of the home. This is very, like, allegorical to the Garden of Eden and eating forbidden fruit and maybe her actually causing this kind of core sin of humanity, right? That humanity does devolve because of her action like this. I like that in the beginning. I fear that, like, I don't think we get enough going forward. We obviously go into some really dark spaces with, like, church and these gods and nature and all of the things that Garland really likes to explore. But I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, it is interesting. Obviously, like, the tour itself is interesting. It's very on the nose. Literally with, like, her eating the apple, and he's just like, oh, mustn't do that, forbidden fruit. Like, he just calls it out. You know, it's like, oh, this isn't
some which I kinda allegory. Like.
Yeah, I think it's great. It's not kind of a, let's see if the audience picks up on it. It's like, no, we're just going to tell them exactly what's going on here, which I feel like it works. And like, to your point, like, maybe we just needed more of it throughout the film. You know, if you're going to be this on the nose, like, with everything, like, that's fine. Go for it. Mm-hmm. I think the tour is interesting. You know, his insistence on, like, oh, I'll get the bags, like, I'm the host, the man, like, I'll take care of it. It's like early on, we kind of realize, oh, there's these roles that people feel like they need to fulfill. So it kind of sets the tone in that aspect for the rest of the movie.
Do you think that Jeffrey as a character, do you think he's funny?
Yeah, for sure.
I think he's hysterical. Yeah. Absolutely hysterical. So there's a couple things that I've noted throughout some of these scenes that I'll call out. So during the tour, when he is first telling Harper of like where everything is, you mentioned the scene with the fruit. He says, tea in the cupboard, milk in the fridge, just where you'd expect to find them.
Yeah.
Totally normal line of dialogue. However, Rory Kinnear delivers it, I'm just like, this guy's a fucking psychopath. Like, this guy's weird. He's just so weird in the way that he talks and his actions. I think this part is among the funniest of the movie because, like you mentioned, he feels he needs to fill these roles. So he goes to all this trouble to get her bags. And then at the very end, he goes, oh, I sort of wish that I'd taken you up on your offer to help me with your bags.
Yeah, exactly.
And I really think it's like him getting to be him. And I wonder if it works so well because we're so introductory into the film of like, oh, wow, he's just Jeffrey. Like, this is just his house that he rents out. It's all good. Like, we don't need to worry about anything else about who he represents or what his character is or how weird he actually is. This is just our introduction to his character. And I think that works really well in this situation.
Yeah, it was great. I just want to add, like, my favorite line probably of the whole movie is when he's like, oh yeah, and the pub is about, pub's just over there. It's a 10 minute walk there. It's a 30 minute walk back. Like, he got a real kick out of it. It's such a funny line. I love it so much. I think that line's great.
That is so funny. Okay, well, since you did your favorite line, I'll do my favorite line as well. I'm sure I'll bring it up again next time. When they're in the pub, speaking of the pub, and Jeffrey is there and he's drinking and Harper comes in, and Harper is telling Jeffrey of like, you know, oh, this naked guy showed up and like the police had to come arrest him. And like he was eating apples from your garden and whatever. And Jeffrey goes, scrumping, hang him. And then, and then he just like continues on with his conversation. And it's like, oh, wow, that's crazy, man. Like,
I
just think it's hilarious. Okay. Next bullet point here. The argument. We get another flashback. Now, this, I think, is the most instrumental scene in understanding Harper and understanding her path for the rest of the film and like her connections with Jeffrey and men in general and all these thematic elements that Garland is trying to convey. This is where James is threatening to kill himself over their relationship and is basically like, if you try to divorce me, I will kill myself. Which, A, like, psychotic. Like, that's an incredibly unhealthy relationship situation. And I think it works well in terms of being a commentary on, like, abusive relationships for females and their loss of power in these abusive relationships and how that loss of power can extend far beyond those moments or those actions and really dictate entirety of like their lives moving forward and who they are and their personalities. Wild argument, like really just 11 out of 10.
I mean, he goes full Michael Scott, like when Jim is pretending to fire him, you know, and he slams his hands on the desk, like, I'm going to kill myself.
He really does though. Yeah,
he does. He just goes full Michael Scott on her. It's just like, damn, dude, like you can't. He's even telling her, it's like, just so you have to live with it. Like, it's amazing from the beginning. Like, even just from that moment, it's like, yeah, obviously this relationship is not going to work out if this is how you're handling this kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's, man, it is an intense argument. And I think she handles it as well as she can. It's like, you can't say that. Like, that's not fair, right? That's not going to be on me. But,
yeah. I think the movie's really interesting in the way that we get this scene, not only so early in the film, but also framed the way that we do, because there is some conversation to be had around the fact of like, we don't know James outside of, well, basically this. Like, this is the only monologue that we hear from James, the only time that we hear him talk. We don't know if there is potentially more to the story. And I think Garland tries to frame it in a way that initially kind of catches you off guard to be like, oh shit, like, okay, she should just be like, okay, I won't divorce you. Like, I got it. Like, don't kill yourself. But of course, that's like completely the opposite of how we should be framing this film and thinking about it. And I think that is part of what he's trying to accomplish here with, you know, Men being the title. Next on the list here, I have Harper's kind of ethereal walk in the forest. Garland, big nature guy. Big nature guy, big woman guy. Very interesting.
Big on nature, big on women. I love it. Put it on a poster, man. Yeah, I mean, this scene's beautiful, though, because I think we connect with Harper, and we kind of feel like this is one of her first moments of freedom and possibly happiness. Independence since all this stuff happened. So it's a super powerful scene that, as we'll talk about in the next moment, just gets taken away from her so quickly. It's so bad. Yeah.
It's shot really well. I love the lighting. I kind of got the sense of voyeurism from our perspective, because we do get one specific camera angle that is like up on top of a hill while she is down walking on the old railroad.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's a very interesting, like, that's a choice that we made, because the rest of the time we're very cinematic and we're with her. Garland, really, what I find most fascinating about him and his films and his scripts is, like, he always feels like he's trying to unlock these secrets of how women and nature, like, work together and work together and against, like, the world at large. I think, obviously, very, you know, pertinent in Annihilation, but a little less so in Ex Machina, but also, like, Ava is a woman and she longs for the nature that's around her. And I think, like, how those things coalesce is really interesting to Garland.
Yeah.
Part of that is so interesting to me because of Civil War. Like, I have no fucking clue where he's going with these themes that he likes to revisit in his next film. So I'm really interested in that. And I think this scene in particular explores that very well. You mentioned the next part, the tunnel singing. This was a big part of the trailer. I remember when the trailer came out, we were like, oh, wow, this is like a horror film. Kind of, but it is a little, it's scary. And I think it's cool the way her voice echoes, and she does feel this kind of childlike wonder of like, oh, cool, this is cool. Like, look what I found in nature. Yeah. Look what I just found in the world, ready for me to have full autonomy over. And then someone gets up from the dark and proceeds to basically follow her through the tunnel. This is the naked guy, right?
It's got to be. And it's interesting because, like, we're with her for at least a few minutes while she's doing this bit.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
This, like, echoing thing, probably close to 5 minutes. And then suddenly the person decides to show themselves. And it's like, oh, okay, shit. Someone's been here the whole time. This is super creepy. But yeah, I assume I was going to ask you who you thought it was, but I think the naked guy makes sense.
I do think it's the naked guy as well, because in the next scene, this naked man who looks like Rory Kinnear, who looks like Jeffrey, shows up at an abandoned house, which she is near after kind of running away from this tunnel. Harper then proceeds to run home in order to avoid this guy. But she took a picture of the house, and that's how she discovers that he was there. He was there at this house. So I think there's something to be said about that kind of dichotomy of Harper having a moment of independence only to be ripped from her by a completely nameless yet identically recognizable man that she knows well. Pretty interesting. Next I have on the list, Harper plays the piano. Now she plays a Chopin song, I believe. And in the beginning, when we're getting the tour, Jeffrey asks her if she plays piano. She says no. And he goes, oh, neither do I.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of funny. But she does. I'm curious your take on why she lies to Jeffrey about not playing the piano.
I think out of maybe just play something then. You know, like the fear of something like that happening. Like, I don't want to do this. Like, I just want to unpack my shit and just, like, be alone. So, no, I don't play piano. Please go away kind of thing. That's kind of what I chalk it up to. It is interesting, though, how many, like, very specific things are brought up during this tour, because there's even that part where he points out, like, you know, I've got to bring it up. Be careful what you flush. You know, I have to tell that to the women because of septic. You know, it's like, it's so interesting this gets brought up here, because, like, it may be so easy to leave that out of the script. Like, there's no call for it necessarily. Like, he chose to put it in there, but it's like, yeah, it's just showing the differences between these two people and all the people she's going to be surrounded by coming up. Like, she is the one woman that's there. Yeah, it's just so interesting.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I noticed that line as well. And the way that it's phrased, he says something along the lines of, like, I tell all the women. He doesn't specifically call out Harper. He doesn't say, oh, I have to tell you. Oh, because you're a woman. He just says, I tell all the women. And he just kind of uses a blanket term, which I think is really interesting in what this movie is trying to tackle, the same idea with men, right? Like, they are just a species. Like, it's just women, men. Like, it's not Harper, it's not Jeffrey. It's just a blanket term for everybody involved in that group, which I think is interesting. I agree with you, though. I really do think it's because, A, she just didn't really want to talk to Jeffrey anymore. I think she was just getting a little burnt out, honestly. And B, I think it is another power thing, where, like, if she says, oh yeah, I do play piano, she hands the power over to Jeffrey to say, like, do this for me, play something for me. And she doesn't want that. And obviously, coming right off of her relationship with James and him killing himself, and her kind of using this as an escape to become a person who she wants to be. I think there's a lot to be said there. Next on the list, naked man is outside of her house. We get another flashback before the man is eventually arrested, which kind of kicks off, like, the back, I guess, 40 minutes of this movie, where things take a turn, get a little weird. But the flashback is of James stealing her phone. She's texting her best friend, Riley, who is, you know, Harper's basically telling Riley, like, he's scaring me. James steals the phone, is like, oh, I'm scaring you, and punches Harper. Harper then basically kicks him out of the house and says, you got to get out of here. Pretty intense scene.
Yeah. I mean, and the end of that scene where she basically just says, like, I don't care if you kill yourself.
I don't fucking care. Yeah. She's like, you will never see me again. Doesn't matter.
Which is just, like, amazing final words to have with somebody who then falls to their death. You know, like, that's what she has to live with.
Mm-hmm.
I feel almost, if he had just left and done it, it'd almost be easier for her to deal with if she hadn't said what she had just said. You know, right. Like, if he took the breakup, was like, I'm going to kill myself. She's like, you can't put that on me. You got to get out of here, whatever. Like, she might be able to distance herself from it some more, but transpiring, you know, with the fight and then her saying that kind of stuff, it's like, yeah, it's got to live with her a little bit longer, which is super rough.
How long do you think Harper and James were married for?
Ooh.
I haven't thought about this, but I'm curious.
I haven't either. I'm going to give him 5 years.
Yeah. Okay.
Together for 7, married for 5.
Oh, interesting. So all around together for 12.
No. Sorry. Like, together for 2, then married for 5 years. So 7 years total. They were together.
Understood.
They were married for 5 of those 7 years.
Okay. Nice. Yeah. I was going to say somewhere in the realm of, like, they kind of struck me as, like, dating for 18 months, married for 3 years, right? Like, maybe a little infantile in their relationship. And I'm curious if that's why James was as hot-headed as he was. And I'm curious if that's why Harper as well might have been asking for a divorce, because things moved a little too quickly. She lost that independence too fast.
Yeah.
The man is arrested. The cops come out. This is the only time in the film we see Harper conversing with another female. And this is a police officer who basically says, like, don't worry, he's not a bad guy. Like, he stinks. We're going to take him down to the station. He needs a wash. But, like, you have nothing to worry about, which I think is interesting, because if I were Harper, I'd battle that a little bit.
Like you said, it's the only woman that she sees in person this whole movie, other than just, like, FaceTiming with her friend. But yeah, the cop just kind of, like, plays it off like, he's harmless. You know, it's whatever. I don't know that I would feel that way about this at all. Like, the naked man is, like, surrounding me, my house or whatever. Like, I harmless is not the word I would use.
No, very strange. Okay, this is where things kind of take a turn. This is where she walks to the church and eventually to the pub. Harper walks to the church. She ends up wailing in the pews of the church, dealing with her trauma, these remembrances of what happened to James. And this is where we very first see the statues, the idols, the imprints, however we want to call them. One of them is essentially a man who is adorned with like leaves. And represents nature. And then we have another side of this big stone cube that is a woman, very visibly has breasts and a vagina that like she is opening up again with Garland and his like fanatic fantasies about like nature and women. Very interesting. And this is where we meet the vicar, who is played by Rory Kinnear as well. Weird looking guy. Really, really creepy looking guy.
So creepy. And honestly, like we meet that little boy too, and also played by Roy Kinnear, and also creepy, you know, then she won't play the game. He calls her, did he say a stupid bitch or something
stupid
like
bitch.
That?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just again, just kind of the commentary on what women have to put up with, you know, it's just like, oh, you won't do what I want you to, like, oh, you're just a stupid bitch. So interesting. I did love the vicar when the kid's like, you'll fuck yourself. He's like, you first. Like, I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah. It's mentioned there as well. Harper says to the vicar, like, oh, I'm just not used to people swearing at a vicar. And then by the end of their conversation, she tells him to go fuck himself as well. So there's something there. Obviously, her conversation with the vicar, he kind of opens up and like is like, hey, it looks like you're hurting. Like, what's going on? She tells him about James. Very awkwardly puts his hand on her knee, a la like Toby and Pam style. And then continues to steer the conversation in a direction, which you mentioned, which is like, maybe you should have forgiven him. Like maybe you shouldn't have made him kill himself. Like it's kind of your fault. And she proceeds to tell him to go fuck himself. And then the vicar puts his hand on the bench where she was sitting and just kind of like caresses it. And you're like, man, this guy's a real fucking freak. Like this guy is a real creep.
Yeah, this is a lonely man for sure, as we find out later on.
Very, very lonely man. Okay, Harper goes to the pub. Briefly mention this. Jeffrey's there, and there are several other versions of Rory Kinnear that are there. One of them is a barkeep. A few of them are just like in tables that are like just hanging out. They're kind of like scoundrels, pub scoundrels. And then the police officer, who is Rory Kinnear as well.
Yeah.
Pretty, like, disconcerting. Like, it's kind of, I don't know. You kind of, like, lose your way a little bit where you're like, oh, these are, okay. I see what we're doing here. Men are all the same. Got it. Yeah. They're all pieces of shit.
Yeah, it is interesting. And it's also where we find out that the naked man has been released.
Yep.
Because, you know, couldn't really charge him with anything. And she is rightfully kind of panicked about that because there's nothing keeping him from going back to the house. So, I thought this was a very well done scene, though, with all the different Rory Kinnears in it.
I think technically it's quite impressive. Yeah. And I think dialogue wise, like it works really well and it's pretty fast. And I mentioned the scrumping hang him a bit that we get. We actually get a lot of good stuff from Jeffrey in this scene.
Yeah.
Who kind of just plays like a purveyor of what is going on, because Harper's really having a conversation with the police officer. But I think there's a lot of societal commentary here of like how people just kind of disregard like women's issues or things that they're concerned about because I'm a man and I'm not scared of the naked guy. So we just let him go. I don't care. And that's kind of how things go. I actually like this scene quite a bit. I think this maybe works the most out of the movie to be like, oh, okay, cool. We're meeting good visuals with impressive technical ability, a great script that is witty and funny and actually is saying something. And it's kind of pushing our character narrative forward a little bit and hearkening on more things. I think it works really well.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, there's a funny line in here too with Jeffrey where she wants to pay for her drink. And he's like, no, I'll pay for it. And they keep going back and forth.
That's so funny.
And then he says the line of like, your legal tender is no good here. And like, man, that's such like a neckbeard thing to say to some woman you're buying her drink. You know, it's just so like, funny. This is so fucking creepy, dude. This is so weird.
The way that he uses legal tender is fucking hilarious to me. Your legal tender is no good here. Okay. Crow in the house. Jeffrey shows up. This one shit starts to get really sideways.
Yeah.
A crow basically runs through the window, breaks the glass, goes into the house. Jeffrey shows up. And obviously Harper thinks it's the naked man intruding or thinks it's a man. Ends up just being a crow. But what I gathered the most out of this scene that I think is the most interesting is that when Jeffrey shows up, he is far less concerned with Harper and her concerns for safety than he is for the well-being of the crow. He apologizes to the crow and he says, oh, I'm so sorry. And he continues to talk to Harper about how it's a broken wing. There's nothing you can do about it. We had to put her out of her misery. I'm so sorry that this crow had to go. Again, very like nature oriented commentary here from Garland. But like that to me was really like not cringy, but definitely like, okay, we're breaching, you know, we're doing things a lot here. We're repeating the same things a lot, but I still think it works here.
That neck twist is brutal, man.
Brutal. Like,
watching that happen.
Wow.
I don't know what it
could
is.
Could you do it? I mean, could you do it? If you were Jeffrey, if that was your house and a crow got in and you would have guessed, could you break the neck of the crow?
I don't think I would do like in the kitchen with them. You know what I mean? It's like just go like outside.
Right out of the gate.
Yeah. He's just like, no hesitation. It's like, all right, well, let's do this. So I don't think I could do that.
No, absolutely not. I could never. I couldn't do it. No, even with a broken wing, I couldn't do it. Okay. Leaf Man shows up. He essentially proceeds to blow what appears to be like dandelion pollen or dusts in Harper's face. Now, this, of course, begs the question, is everything after this real? Is it Harper's imagination? Like, are we living through Harper's brain after this? Because of the absurdity of what is taking place with all of the characters and especially the eternal birth, could that just be a physical manifestation of Harper's traumas?
Yes, until the post-title card scene. Then it makes you think like, oh, maybe this actually happened. Because then her friend, Riley, sees the effects of all of this that has taken place. It's like, oh shit, did this actually happen? But I don't know, maybe that was just like a manifestation as well. Like it was stuff happening, but not that literal, you know, as we were seeing it. But the Leaf Man is creepy. He's got one of the coolest scenes early on where he like cuts the slit in his forehead.
So
just
badass.
Shoves the leaf in there. It's like, damn, dude. All right, cool.
You're committed.
This is an intense character for sure.
Yeah, it is. And of course, Rory Kinnear, which is really off-putting. Like, the more you invest in this movie, the more off-putting it is. Okay, let's. I'm gonna go through this here because this is kind of what I've deemed the house maze. So this is when all of the things start to combine and happen.
Yeah.
The kid has a split arm, which we didn't talk about. Basically, someone sticks their arm in the letterbox.
Dude.
And Harper proceeds to stab it in the forearm and he drags his forearm out, thus splitting his hand, much in a similar vein to what James endured.
Yeah. So then every version of Jeffrey, of the men that we see from there on out, have the split hands, which is nuts.
Yes. Really creepy.
Yeah. I know we're going to get to it, but the vicar, like,
oof.
With the split hands around
disgusting.
Her neck.
Disgusting. Like, oh, disgusting. I mean, obviously, there's a lot to say there in terms of, like, it, you know, a man in that position with that type of power can feel like he has three hands. He can feel like he can control things bigger than he actually can. Okay. The kid has the split arm. He shows up. He's dragging his mask, his very creepy mask, by the way, over the crow on the table. basically beckoning Harper to murder him, and she can't do it because if this is in her mind or her hallucination, whatever it may be, her guilt is driving her away from actioning on something that she knows is logical, to kill him. She gets chased by another man that tries to run just like fucking 40-yard dash through the door.
Yeah.
And she goes to a back room. I think it's pretty smart the way she gets kind of cornered in the house. So she gets chased by another man into the back room. The vicar comes in. The vicar shows up in this kind of back bedroom. He has a split hand as well. I think we should talk about this scene for a moment, because you've got to hand it to Rory Kinnear for like being the creepiest guy in the universe.
Oh God.
In the vicar. Like, I just like performance wise, pretty impressive.
Yeah, no, I want to say that I felt that way the whole time, but his performance in this movie is solid. He's so good in all these different roles. Like, he's doing like James McAvoy split.
He is.
You know what I mean? Like, he's committed to every single version of this character, and he plays it full tilt. And I think that's awesome. And this last scene with the vicar is so fucking creepy. It is so creepy.
He asks Harper when she lost her virginity. He basically is kind of conveying this idea that it's Harper's fault that he's obsessed with her, because she just exudes this sexual prowess, and she exudes this inability to be captured, essentially, by him. She then kills the vicar, and then the score divulges into what her cave song was, which I think is really interesting. Pretty intense scene. You mentioned that he wraps his split arm around her throat, and basically they kind of get pinned up against the wall, and then she then proceeds to like to kill him as he is proceeding nearly to sexually assault her. This is probably where things start to take the turn of like, okay, Alex Garland, I had it in the first 30 minutes. Like, I understood what you were doing, and this is dark and it's weird and it's kind of cool, but it's also like really fucked up. Like, maybe we just don't go this route.
Yeah, it is interesting, you know, especially again, that vicar sequence, like having someone that grew up myself in a religious household and part of a religion where they did put a lot of the responsibility on men's behaviors towards the way women dressed, you know, it's just like, make sure you dress modest because you don't want to give the boys impure thoughts. It's like, that's not the girl's fault. That's on the boys. You know what I mean? Like, they've got to take responsibility for that shit, but they don't. They just like, they put it on the women to dress modestly so the boys can control themselves. And I feel like this is just a different version of that. And again, just kind of speaking to like, you can't even you're held responsible for things that aren't even your fault or in your control. And yeah, it's such a good scene, like just the satisfaction of her killing him, you know, in the manner that it's all taking place. And yeah, this is kind of when it really is just like, all right, where are we going from here? This is where are we at?
Agreed. This is where things truly become unhinged. And you know, I think there's a lot to break down here. I think we'll talk about this here. So we've got the eternal birth. I'm going to explain what happens, because I wrote this down because I knew that we needed to discuss this and figure this out. So the tree man is outside, and then Harper proceeds to find herself outside, basically standing toe to toe with this tree man. He then gives birth to the boy, the little baby, the little Rory Kinnear. That is the boy. The boy then proceeds to give birth to the vicar. In some very graphic scenes, by the way. Obviously evoking the statue that we've been kind of pseudo obsessed with for half of the movie. The vicar then proceeds to have a vagina on his spine, which I thought was fucking crazy, and gives birth to Jeffrey, the Jeffrey that we know from this movie. Jeffrey is the first man to stand and to pursue Harper. He then gets to a doorway and he kind of seizes up. He gives birth out of his mouth, feet first, to James, Harper's ex-husband at this point. James then proceeds to walk to Harper on the couch and has a little bit of a dialogue and essentially says, "You did this to me. I want your love." And then we see Harper kind of walk over to the axe and we get a title card. We get a title card basically all the way through this movie, which put a pin in that, I think, is interesting. Then Riley arrives, her best friend that the night before said she would be coming, or I guess the morning before. Riley herself is pregnant. And then Harper smiles and then we cut to black. There's a lot to unpack here. I didn't mention right before we get this eternal birth, this is where Jeffrey steals Harper's car.
Oh, yeah.
And steals Harper's car, drives away. We get a very cool pan up to Harper gazing at the stars and the Milky Way that is around her and trying to understand her place in the universe, only for us to pan back down and Jeffrey to go truly berserk and drive towards her, crash the car. Then this is where the eternal birth starts. Give me your thoughts. Give me what's going on your mind, like, when you're watching this scene.
I mean, it's so busy and so kind of crazy this last like 20, 30 minutes. Because, I mean, yeah, Jeffrey steals a car, but that's after he got hit by the car, you know? And then he's just like, all right, cool. Now I'm going to take it. I'm going to hit you, which is, you know, kind of intense. And then, yeah, all of these different versions just giving birth to each other. Just from seeing that the first time in the theater, it's just like, what in the fuck am I watching? Who came up with this idea?
It
was so intense. But then the Riley stuff, because you wonder, like, is this in her imagination? Is this just like kind of surreal, but not actually what's going on? And then Riley shows up and we see the remnants of the evening. We see the car smash. We see the blood leading into the front door. Like, we see all this stuff. And it's like, oh my God, this actually happened. You know, I have no idea. Obviously none of us really know, but I don't know. I think it's interesting. And the fact that it is like so thought provoking and like makes you talk about it, I think to me shows its effectiveness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree with you. I think the fact that we're trying to dissect and figure out, no matter how maybe off-putting or distasteful it could be or might come across to some viewers, I think is worth some merit. Riley being pregnant at the end, what does that mean? Like, what does that mean to you? How do you interpret that? Because we just spent the last 15 minutes watching pregnant guys give birth.
Yeah, I have no idea. This is where, you know, maybe the subconscious comes in. You know, when you think about a small thing for 3 seconds during the day and then suddenly it's in your dream later that evening. It's like, oh my God, that was so weird.
How it is with you. I pod with you and I'm like, oh my God.
And then I'm just there. And I'm just like, yeah, I love Babylon. Let's watch it again. Let's run it back.
Wow, you really are in my dreams. That's crazy. That's what your dreams are like, right?
Can we do another Babylon episode? Yeah, that's what I wonder, if it's just like the friend was pregnant. And so that's why she's envisioning all this stuff again, like kind of in her imagination. I don't know. I'm not sure, but I think that's what's great about it.
That's my big question as well. I think there's something there for sure. I just am curious what it is. I think having the title card at the very end of the film is a bold choice. You know, I think we talk about sometimes you wouldn't know, but like Babylon's title card doesn't show up until 40 minutes into the film. There are some other movies that are notable where it's just like the title card is kind of prolonged as a statement.
Do people get that far in Babylon without turning it off?
God.
That's crazy to me. That's nuts.
Some of us do, you know, the hive, small but mighty. So yeah, I think it's interesting. I just don't really know how else to describe this movie besides like fascinating. Like I think it's trying to say a million things and some of them work and some of them don't. And a lot of it's heavy handed, but a lot of it's pretty nuanced. And like, I find that intriguing. Like, I think that's part of the reason that I like this movie is because I think there's a lot there. And whether it works for you or it doesn't work for you is part of what makes the movie interesting. Like, I think it's Alex Garland trying to do weird fucking shit and like just being addicted to like trying to figure out nature and women and just being like, you know, this is it. The big takeaways that I had were how like the carnality of man has succeeded for generations. I think this eternal birth that we get from someone that is born of nature, again, like very biblical allegories here with Adam, and kind of like creating more life from himself. And we get then a kid and we kind of keep growing up and then eventually we get to James. I think like that just shows like generationally, like man has always been this way and will always yeah. continue to be this way and will always treat women this way. And you know, that's problematic in and of itself. And I think that's the point. Are you going to choose the eternal birth for your true cinema? Is that your favorite part?
10 minutes there, 30 minute walk back, man. That's the best part of the whole movie for me. I love it.
Yeah, it's a good one. I'm going to choose the pub, like I mentioned. I think you mentioned the legal tender bit. I said the scrumping, hang him. I think that part's
scrumping
hilarious.
Is such a cool word.
Scrumping. It's awesome. Really, really good stuff. Okay. A1 act. Last time we did this, I believe we did Rory Kinnear. I believe we did Jesse Buckley. And I don't know. I don't know if we did anything. Oh, I think we did Vacation's Gone Bad. Because obviously okay. This was a vacation that gone had
can't
gone
believe
very
that episode
awry.
Was 37 minutes. We're an hour in and we're barely getting to it now.
I don't even know how we talked about this movie. We were probably just like so overwhelmed. We were just like, I don't know what the fuck to say.
Yeah, it was just 37 minutes of us like, whoa.
Okay, we're gonna do surprise endings because of course this is a surprise ending. There's no way in hell anybody that doesn't know anything about men goes into this movie and is like, you know what? I think the last 15 minutes are going to be this and gets it right. There's
Can
no
you
way.
Imagine? No.
that would be something. Okay, so we got Men, obviously. We've got Raw, Fight Club, Memento, Shutter Island. I put The Game on here.
Yeah.
I felt like it partially qualifies, if not all the way qualifies. They Clone Tyrone, Parasite, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, The Descent, Gone Girl, The Departed, Psycho, The Sixth Sense, Old Boy, Primal Fear, The Cabin in the Woods, The Prestige, The Usual Suspects, Uncut Gems, The Village, and I put Saw on here. Now, these are not necessarily twist endings, just surprising endings that generally you would not be able to figure out the path of in the first two-thirds of the film.
Yeah, for sure. Mine is not on this list. It's the first one that I remember, the first surprise ending that I remember really affecting me as a kid, because I'm sure I saw this too young, but it's Seven.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The ending of that movie was just like, whoa, what? You know, that blew my mind as a young adolescent. And it's still to this day just one of the most effective endings because, like, he got what he wanted. You know what I mean? Like, he got to fulfill everything. So. Yeah, that's what I'm going to go with. I'm going to go Seven.
Speaking of biblical allegories, damn, impressive. Yeah. Okay, Seven. I haven't seen that movie for a while. Look, I mean, come on. I'd be remiss if I didn't say Uncut Gems. Like, that was really the first movie I saw where it was like, oh, fuck. Yeah. Like, the final 2 minutes. Like, we had it all going for us, and then not. I remember being thoroughly shocked in the theater. I would say as a backup, I recently watched Old Boy for the first time when it went on its 4K restoration run, probably 6 months back. I didn't know anything about that movie going in, completely blind, had never seen a trailer, nothing. And by the time I got to the end of that movie, I was like a little stunned. I was just kind of like glued to my seat as the credits rolled. And I was like, wow, that's a lot to take in the way that movie ended.
That's a lot.
So pretty intense. Yeah. I think a lot of good picks here on the list. Okay.
Your old boy hammer back there.
Yeah, I do. I do have my old boy hammer back here.
Yeah, I like it.
Apparently set used. It's a prop. So nice. It's shout out Neon on an A24 pod. Love to see it. Okay, A24 ranking for Men. This is where the rubber hits the road. This is where we gotta figure out what the rub is on Men. Cause last time you mentioned we just had a fucking catch all. We were just like, yeah, good time. Like it's like I didn't have a bad time. So
yeah.
This is a little bit more prestige ranking.
C+.
C+.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not good enough to be in the B category, but above average because of the performances that we get here.
Okay.
That's my rationale.
I think that's good. I think that's a very good rationale. If for the sake of being different and for the sake of podcast content here, I'm going to go with a B minus. I'm just going to go one step up from you because I feel like I like this movie more than most people, which means I probably like it more than you. And I don't like it enough to be like, oh, you're looking for an A24 movie? You should toss on Men. Like, I will never tell anybody that. But I do think it's worth watching. And I think it is a fascinating film led by really good performances, both funny and dramatic.
I like it.
We got to get Jessie Buckley in other stuff. Like, we just got to keep getting her in movies that are probably not movies like this, but like good movies.
Yeah.
And shout out Sophie Holsinger, our co-host on the Movie Draft podcast. I tweeted that I was rewatching this film and she commented that she made a note after seeing this in her iPhone that said things I never need to see again. And Men was the only one on the list. And she got a lot of traction on that tweet. My tweet, however, not a lot of traction, but a lot of people agreed with Sophie. So congratulations, Sophie. You outplayed me on my own tweet.
Sophie's got the juice. She's got the juice.
She does. She's got the juice. Men. Kind of not really, has the juice. No. Okay, we've done it. We've talked about Men, the much dreaded rewatch, preparing for Civil War.
For almost twice as long as we did the first time. Almost twice as long. It's crazy.
We've spent a combined like 100 minutes of our life talking about Men into microphones.
You've spent one half of a Babylon talking about Men.
Ugh, gross.
That's crazy.
Next week on the pod, we're sticking with Alex Garland. Yeah. It's time for Civil War. Ben, you're excited, right?
I cannot wait. It's my most anticipated. I cannot wait.
Like, you think it's going to be good, right?
I'm hopeful for sure. I mean, the dude's track record is pretty solid, and I feel even better having rewatched this. Like, I think this is going to be good. If he exhausted himself in the director's chair so much during this movie that he wants to take a break, I'm like, hell yeah. I think he gave everything he has. So let's see it.
Yeah. I'm with you. I'm really excited for Civil War. I've heard good things. I am very, very fascinated by Alex Garland, to say the least. So I think I have a lot of trust in him and what he's going to create. I think it is a really pertinent topic for what's going on in the world right now. And I'm really interested to see how he tackles that and like what he does. Because I think this is very different from anything else that he has done. Probably the closest thing would probably be Annihilation, but that's hard sci-fi. This is not sci-fi in the slightest.
No, I'm super stoked. We're gonna see a little bit of Nick Offerman, you know, Kirsten Dunst, Gil Kiki, and Jesse Plemons.
Kaylee Spaney, the future of cinema?
Yeah. Wow. Priscilla, baby, let's go.
Wow.
I'm stoked. It's gonna be fun. And speaking of fun. Let us know what you guys thought about Men. Did you guys rewatch this with us? Are you guys doing some Alex Garland prep? Let us know.
Where are my Men heads at? where's the crew?
Oh my God. What would that even be? Oh my God. I can't even think of that.
It'd be the most dystopian shit known to man. It'd be terrible. I do not associate with the Men heads out there.
Hashtag not all Men heads. Let us know what you think. We're on Twitter and Instagram at 24 minutes of A24. You can also watch us on YouTube, see our beautiful faces as we talk about these movies, see me try to stifle some of these yawns because I'm like tired for some reason. I don't really understand why, but thank you everyone
Garland,
for your support.
He sucks it all out of you, man. Garland just requires just like the most.
Taking all my energy. The Civil War is going to be a nightmare. I'm going to have some Red Bulls or something. So.
Oh, yeah, big time.
Yeah, thanks everyone for your support. Thanks for listening. We appreciate it. I am Ben Lawhorn.
And I am Ethan Simi. Spring break forever, bitches.